Welcome back home. As I said earlier, I saw many of you last Sabbath for our first Sabbath after the feast, but attendance was low as some of you were still traveling and others were not feeling quite up to par. But by today, everyone is home from the feast, and most have recovered from the travels and gotten over any bugs that might have joined along with you along the way. That never quite seems right, but once again, this three-week holy day window that we enjoy between the Feast of Trumpets and the Last Great Day has closed again much more quickly than we wish that it would. And we move on to whatever comes next. Now, even as you observed the Feast of Tabernacles and Last Great Day this year, probably many of you started looking ahead to next year. Talk of possible new feast sites always sprouts up while we're observing the feast. We learned that there could be a feast site in Utah, maybe Myrtle Beach, probably a replacement for the Catskills. And there's always special interest that people have in international sites. Those that are in the British Isles are always popular, and maybe even someplace in Europe. But I have a suggestion for you this afternoon. Before we get ahead of ourselves, I would submit that now is the time to keep this year's feast. Now, in the member letter that Mr. Franks sent out, and I sent a copy of it to you, there are more copies at the information table, Mr. Franks emphasizes the importance of learning and remembering lessons from our feast this year before we move on to next year. When I got the letter, I read it with great interest because it seemed like he was peeking at my notes that I was preparing for the sermon today. So I'll just say that in my own defense that I really was thinking along this line before I received his letter. But as usual, Mr. Franks always makes the point better than I can. And he emphasized the importance of remembering the lessons from the feast we just experienced. Read a couple of quotes, short quotes from the letter. Mr. Franks wrote that it's easy for one feast to blend into the next one without really stopping to ask ourselves, what did I learn this year? Over the years, we mostly identify the feast with where we were and who we were with. Then Mr. Franks goes on to list the places where he has observed the feast with his wife and family over the years. It made me think back to my first feast experience. I've mentioned before was with my family when I was just a youngster. We went to Big Sandy, Texas in 1959 was my first feast. I'll spare you the math. It's 59 years since that time, which is remarkable since right now I'm 46 years old. But since that time, since we first began to keep the feast, first of all, of course, with my family and later with my own family, we've observed the feast in Squaw Valley for many years. In 1960 to 1976, we observed the feast in Squaw Valley. With my family, and then as a college student, and then later with my own family. Well, all those years, you were going to the Poconos year after year after year. I was going to Squaw Valley year after year after year. And, you know, it became kind of a second home. You knew exactly where everything was, where were the best places to stay, and where the best parking lot was to get out sometime within 4 hours after services. But after Squaw Valley, my wife and I, by then, had our own family. We've been to Spokane and Seattle, Washington for the feast, Lake of the Ozarks, St. Petersburg, Eugene, Oregon, Biloxi, Mississippi, Dayton, Ohio, Orlando, and, of course, a number of different sites in and around the Poconos area for the last several years. And we've had a chance to visit or go to some exotic international foreign sites, too, like Jekyll Island, Collingwood, Ontario, Barbados, And in recent years, Mr. Horchak has asked us to go to Sri Lanka and then to South Africa. So those are very special occasions for us. And then this most recent year, of course, we were in Jamaicamon. So that was it's been a very interesting time for us. And for the most part, the only time any of us really travels is usually for the Feast of Tabernacles. And you've had many opportunities over the years to go to some very interesting places inside in the United States and internationally as well. And we do tend to consider and think of the places we've been and, of course, the people we were with as we observe the feast. Anyway, Mr. Franks continues, says, soon the feast of 2018 will be a faint memory. But before that happens, I want to encourage each one of us to answer the question, what did I learn this year? It may not have been an earth-shattering lesson, and you may not be able to narrow it down to just one lesson. But the point is, again, breaking out of the letter, the point is that we didn't just go to the feast to enjoy it, the physical trip and the vacation. We went to the feast as a learning experience. The feast was something we don't just go to, it's something that we do experience. It's been mentioned many times, even those who were not able to travel to the Feast of Tabernacles had a Feast of Tabernacles experience, heard messages that the church provided for them during that time. And I'm sure there was a lot of thought given to the meaning and to how they were experiencing the feast this time. Mr. Franks goes on in his letter to list four lessons that were reinforced in his life at the feast this year. First of all, the value and importance of God's calling. Secondly, the personal responsibility we each have because of our calling. Third, the responsibility we have to our family. And fourth, the responsibility we have to fellow members. And Mr. Franks suggests that we each give careful thought to what the lessons were that we brought home this year. As we consider the feast from that perspective, the title of the message this afternoon is, It's Time to Keep the Feast. Now, we commonly use the word keep to mean observe. We keep the holy days. We find, in fact, the English word keep used in that way in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 8, where Paul writes, speaking of the days of unleavened bread, let us keep the feast. So it's not wrong to think of the word, to think of keeping the feast in the context of observing the feast. And in that context, or in that sense, we've already observed the Feast of Tabernacles for this year, as well as all the rest of the holy days as well. The Greek word that's used in that instance in 1 Corinthians 5 actually means to celebrate a feast. It is actually it's a unique word that does relate directly to the observance of a festival. But if we look at it in a bigger sense, the English word keep has a broader meaning. The word keep in the English language means to have or retain possession. To keep refers not to something that passes or something that we just simply observe, but to keep refers to something that we have ownership of and that we maintain control over. We all take special effort to keep things that are important to us. They may or may not have great monetary value, but what's important to us are things that we keep and that we maintain possession of and that we cause to continue in our lives. Consider the way that Jesus uses the word in Matthew 19, verse 17. In Matthew 19, verse 17, Jesus told a young man who had asked him about this, he said that if you will enter into life, keep the commandments. Keep the commandments. Now, we know that God's instructions are not just arbitrary requirements. They have meaning and substance. His instructions are commands that we are to embrace and which become the foundation of our lives. And we assume, in a sense, an ownership of the commands that God has given to us because of the importance they take in our lives, and they become a central part of the way that we live. The Greek word that's used in this instance, in Matthew 19:17, means to guard from loss or injury by watching closely. To guard from loss or injury by watching closely. In other words, simply to take care of. We don't just obey the commandments. They become part of our life. We perpetuate them. We guard that understanding and that truth by the way that we live. And we take care of. We nurture, we grow in our understanding of those instructions. So in other words, to keep means to protect and to hold close something that is important and valuable. So we should keep the feast. We've observed it, we've enjoyed it, we've rejoiced in it, we've learned lessons from it, and now we keep the feast. We might ask, well, how do we do that? How do we keep the feast? You know, as a church, we have some jargon. We sometimes might call it church speak. Phrases that mean something to us that would not mean anything to someone outside of the church. One of the phrases that is common to us is feast fever. And it describes, of course, the anticipation we feel as we look ahead to observing the Feast of Tabernacles each year. Another phrase that part of our church speak or part of our church jargon is used to describe what it's like to come home after the feast. We call that post-feast letdown. And it's something that we all deal with, that we've had such an exciting and special time at the feast that we come home and, well, it's good to be home. I was glad to be back home, but yet there's a certain sense of disappointment that the feast is over again, and now we're back to the routine of our everyday life, to the real life that we live for now. So I think we can acknowledge that the Feast of Tabernacles and the Last Great Day, those 8 days plus the travel to and from, are a unique time of the year. They're not something we can duplicate any time other than that, because they're a special time, and I think God would intend for it to be that way. So I don't think we should expect when we come home from the feast that everything will be just like it was at the feast. Otherwise, the feast wouldn't really be the feast, right? It has to be something special for us. But at the same time, we deal with the change when we come back after the feast. During that week, we're all together as God's people. We're immersed in the teaching and the promise and the understanding of the time when Jesus Christ will rule over the earth. It's very encouraging, a very inspiring time of year. And the reminders of our place in God's kingdom and our opportunity to serve and reign with Jesus Christ is something that we get very excited about as we anticipate that time to come. It gives us a renewed expectation, a vision of the world that is to come. But again, after that, we come home to the reality of today's world, and it can hit us pretty hard. The day after I got home, I started watching the news again. And it picked up right where it left off before I left. The political hostilities, the international threats and unrest, the crime, the turmoil, the chaos of a world that is struggling under the deception of Satan. And on top of that, if you've been to Walmart or Costco recently, you see that we're already back into the season of pagan observances. Heard my first Christmas carol at Sam's Club the other day. First for this season. So here we go. So again, my question today is, after the excitement and the inspiration of the feast is over, how do we continue to keep the feast? What can we keep of the feast as we continue through the year? Certainly, we look forward to the next cycle of holy days. But Passover 2019 is 6 months away. This is that long, dark tunnel of time that we enter into. We can see light 6 months down the road, but it's out there and it's at some distance. So how do we maintain the inspiration and encouragement and the benefits of the lessons that we learned from this year? Well, there's no simple, specific answer, but I'm going to suggest this afternoon three ways that we can continue in and keep the lessons that we've learned from this year's Feast of Tabernacles. You're going to find them familiar, but I think that that's okay because something familiar is something that we'll be able to identify with and perhaps find useful as we move into these next several months. So let's review three ways, and you can add more to them, of course, but I'll share with you three ways that we can continue in and keep what we've learned from this year's feast. Number one, keep the feast by carefully observing the weekly Sabbath. Keep this year's feast by carefully observing the weekly Sabbath. Now, you know all about the Sabbath. It's not my intent to try to prove to you that we should observe the Sabbath. You know all about the Sabbath. You've been observing it. But I want to emphasize how observing the Sabbath carefully each week can help us to keep the feast. One thing that we need to be aware of is that keeping the Sabbath week after week, year after year, can become just another routine. And that's something that we should guard against. You've been observing the Sabbath for years, decades. Perhaps some of you, all of your life, you've observed the Sabbath. So what makes this Sabbath or the next Sabbath special? Isn't it just a normal, regular part of our lives? Well, let's consider Exodus 20. Now, you've read this passage beginning in verse 8 1,000 times. You've memorized it. If you grew up in the church, then this was part of your memory work when you were in a YES or a Sabbath school class. So this, again, is something that you're very familiar with, but let's look at it in the context of what we want to emphasize today. Exodus chapter 20, verse 8, says, "Remember the Sabbath to keep it holy." Remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. The word remember, the Hebrew word translated here, means to be mindful of or to call to remembrance. To be mindful of or to call to remembrance. This is not a thou shalt or thou shalt not commandment. This is an instruction to us that places the Sabbath day at the center of life. Life revolves around the Sabbath, and it's something that we remember, that we continually call to mind, that all of the time. We've said many times before that the Sabbath commandment is not just something that we obey once every 7 days. The Sabbath is something that we remember, that we call to mind, that we are mindful of at all times. As you begin early in the week, whether subconsciously or in a more literal sense, you're already beginning to plan your life in preparation for the Sabbath next week. Remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. Again, the Sabbath is something that we don't just kind of acknowledge from one week to the next. It's something that we keep, something that we guard. It's something that we make, that has a special place in our lives. It's part of what is us. We keep the Sabbath. Beyond just a weekly observance, it becomes, as we've seen here, something that's at the center of our lives. We're told to keep it holy. We recognize this time of the Sabbath as holy time. That means that it's God's time, or it's time that God is in. Some of you will remember, as I do, back in the early to mid-1990s, there were those, some even in leadership positions, who scoffed at the term holy time, and that the Sabbath was in some way different than any other day of the week. But Scripture says clearly that it is a day that is holy, and we maintain it. We protect it, we guard it, we practice it as something that is holy. Of course, holy means that it's God's time, something that God is in. It's a day that we maintain in a very distinct sense of dignity and purpose. It's a day that's different from any other day of our week. So we build our lives around it. We take it as a personal possession, and we keep it and recognize it to be time that is holy. The next couple of verses talk about not working on the Sabbath, you or anyone in your household. Let's drop down to verse 11. Four in 6 days. Now, this, in other words, this is telling us why we remember the Sabbath and keep it holy. It's because in 6 days, the Lord made the heavens, the earth, and the sea, and all that is in them. We, on the Sabbath day, are reminded and we recognize who God is. We have a God who has created us and everything around us. And He, then, is the one that keeping the Sabbath reminds us and puts us in remembrance, puts us back in the context of the God who created us. Now, think about the implications of that. We realize that God has created us, and God has created us for a purpose. And we just rehearse much of that purpose as we were at these Fall Holy Days celebrations. God has created us not just arbitrarily, but again for a reason. We know from Genesis 1, verse 26, that He made us in His image. Why did He do that? Why did He do that? Because we have the opportunity to learn the qualities that God Himself has. And He created us that way. As we consider the creation, as we observe the Sabbath day, we honor and recognize God for who He is, what He has given us, what He's going to give us. It expands our thoughts about God and reminds us continually of Him. Therefore, it says at the end of verse 11, the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and He hallowed it. God has blessed this day. This day is the only day that God specifically blessed. Now, He gave us the rest of the week, but this is the day that He has specifically blessed. This is the day that has His mark on it, so to speak. It's the day that is a blessing to us and is a day that is He wants to be special be special in our minds. It's a different day. He blessed the Sabbath day and He hallowed the Sabbath. The Hebrew word translated hallow means to lift up or exalt. To lift up or exalt. It means to purify or sanctify. This is the day that God has exalted above all the other days of the week. This is the day that God has intended for us to honor him for who he is. This is a time that is holy, that he has placed his blessing upon. And it's a day set aside for his purpose. Now in Isaiah 58, we're told that we need to keep our foot off of the Sabbath. And when we do that, then God will bless us. Well, the reason we keep our foot off of the Sabbath is that this isn't our day. This is not your day. It's your day to worship God. In a sense, it is our day, but it's not the day we do what we would choose to do. It's the day that we honor God by the way that we observe the time that he's provided for us. Every Sabbath day has that level of importance. We observe it every week, but it doesn't make it common. It is a day that each time we observe should be special and something that we recognize, look forward to, and live and behave ourselves on that day in a way that would please him. Genesis chapter 2, verse 3. Again, another verse you've read how many hundreds of times? Genesis chapter 2. The first couple of verses summarize God's finishing his creation. And then it says in verse 2 that on the seventh day, God ended the work that he had done and rested. So, 6 days, God worked, God labored, and he completed the creation. And on the seventh day, he stopped working. Now, God doesn't get tired like we do. God doesn't have to come home at the end of the day or end of the week and collapse on the couch and just, you know, feel exhausted. But God did stop working when it came to the seventh day. And he completed his labor in those first 6 days. Again, it says here in verse 3 that God blessed this day, as we saw in Exodus, and he sanctified this day. Sanctify is very much like the word hallow. It means that God has set this day aside in a ceremonial sense, that it's pure and it is for him. It is not for any other use. It is for sacred use only. It's not for other use. Again, no other day of the week is blessed. No other day of the week is sanctified. Now, we can receive God's blessings all week long. I'm not saying that we don't receive his blessings, but this is the day he specifically and in a very special way put his blessing upon. Sometimes we glide smoothly into the Sabbath. And at sunset on Friday, we're relaxed, we're sitting back, maybe have a little glass of wine, and just relax and appreciate and enjoy the Sabbath day. I kind of picture in my mind that's the ideal. That's the way, you know, maybe it's the way it's portrayed in The Fiddler on the Roof. You know, it's just this very special day that everything leads up to and everything just perfect as the Sabbath begins. And sometimes we have those kinds of weeks that lead us to a Sabbath that's that way. Sometimes we crash land into the Sabbath. Sometimes we come into the Sabbath frazzled and worn out and frustrated after the turmoil of a difficult week. And that kind of Sabbath, you know, sometimes it depends on the time of the year somewhat also. We're coming now into the time of year when the sun will begin setting much earlier. And sometimes it becomes a challenge to have everything ready, to have everything the way you'd like for it to be by the time it comes to be sunset on Friday evening. A lot of times, you know, it's a rush to get home and to get settled in. It's not an easy thing to do, but it's an important thing for us to do. It's important for us to realize how God views it and what he has given to us, the blessing he wants us to enjoy, even though sometimes it's hard to make the transition from our busy, full week to setting that aside and refocusing our attention in a different way. But the Sabbath is an opportunity for us, as we said already, to be reminded of our purpose, to focus on God, His creation, on His plan, and what our part in it is. The Sabbath is a reboot. The Sabbath is a time to start anew. It helps us to put our lives in the context of God's purpose. Now, throughout the week, we have contact with God every day. You pray, you study, you meditate on His Word, you apply it, and very carefully as you go through the activities or the events of a day. And God is a part of our life at all times. We always walk with God. We always stay close to Him. But remember, even as it says in Exodus 20, those first 6 days are our days. Those are the days for our work, for our labor. And the seventh day is set aside to be used in a different way. So on the seventh day, we focus on our connection with God. I was going to say we reconnect with God, but that's not really what I mean. We're connected with God all week long, but this is the day to set everything else aside and focus specifically on Him. It gives us an opportunity to put life in perspective and to be reminded again of what it is, that life is more than all that busyness and activity that we're involved in the rest of the week. Turn with me to Ecclesiastes chapter 2. Ecclesiastes chapter 2. You see, I'm going to suggest, based on what is said here, that Solomon did not observe the Sabbath. Ecclesiastes chapter 2. Now, I know later, at the end of the book, he speaks of how the whole duty of man is to obey the commandments of God. So maybe he kind of put things back in perspective. But consider what he says here about life in general, about the work of life. Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 17. He says, "Therefore I hated life, because the work that was done under the sun was distressing to me, for all is vanity and grasping for the wind. Therefore I hated all my labor in which I toiled under the sun." See, at this point, all Solomon could see was his own labor, his own work, his own efforts. And he found it was empty. It was not something that accomplished much of anything. For all that he would accomplish, he would die and pass it along to somebody else who probably would be a fool and wouldn't deserve what he had built. That was Solomon's perspective. And so the labor of life became a burden to Solomon. And he says he hated life because it just didn't make any sense. Now, a lot of people accomplish a lot in this life. There are a lot of people who are just wealthy beyond our ability to comprehend. I mean, they live in a whole different universe, it seems, because of the wealth that they've put together. And but really, when it comes to the conclusion of their life, what do they have? Now, Jesus spoke of the wealthy man who didn't have enough storage space for all that he possessed, so he built more barns. And he was proud of himself. He said, "Now I can take care of myself the rest of my life because I've got all this wealth I've accumulated." And Jesus said, "You fool. Today you die. So what? So what that you have all that?" That's what life is apart from the purpose that God has given to us. The Sabbath, again, reconnects us to, refocuses us on God and on His purpose. And it makes our labor, our effort, make some sense because we're laboring within God's law, and we're blessed by God for our labors, and we can see beyond just the immediate. The busyness of life can be overwhelming. The cares of this world can burden us down. The things we have to do to support ourselves, to support our family, all that labor is important and necessary. But it's exhausting. And all by itself, it's not rewarding. It's never ending. The Sabbath gives us a break from that effort so we can put it in perspective. And we can keep the lessons that we've learned from the feast and from other experiences in context as we observe the Sabbath. So one way we can keep those lessons and experiences is to carefully observe the Sabbath day. Be careful not to just stumble into and stumble through the Sabbath. Be careful that the Sabbath itself doesn't just become part of your routine. But remember the importance that God places upon it and the value that is in it. Remember the Sabbath. Remember its value and its purpose. Keep it holy. In a sense, we kind of have to carve the Sabbath out of the rest of our lives. We have to protect that day so that we observe it in a way that God intended. It is an oasis for us, and again, not just a routine. So that's one way that we can preserve our connection to God and His plan and those things that we emphasize as we observe the Feast of Tabernacles. The Sabbath, in effect, is a mini-feast that God gives to us every week to draw us back into that perspective and that frame of mind. Let's consider another way that we might be able to keep the feast. We can keep the feast as we continue into this next year by remembering that every day is a challenge. Every day is a challenge. Now, I want to put this in a negative way. I don't mean to be pessimistic or fearful, but the reality is that each day has its challenges, and if we're not prepared for that, then we're likely not to meet the challenges. A few minutes ago, we talked about how that every week is different, and we get to the Sabbath day. Sometimes we're ready to relax, and sometimes we're all tensed up. Each week is different as we approach the Sabbath. The reason each week is different is probably because each day is different. You know, sometimes you get up in the morning and you're ready to take on the world. Sometimes you get up in the morning and you don't want to get up. This is old. You've heard this about the guy who wakes up in the morning and he says, "I don't want to go to school today. The kids are mean. The classes are boring. The teachers are stupid. The food in the cafeteria is awful. I don't want to go to school." And his wife says, "But honey, you have to go to school. You're the principal." Sometimes we just don't want to face what we know we're going to have to deal with from one day to the next. Now, some people by their temperament are generally optimistic. Some people tend to be more sensitive or to be more worriers or pessimistic. We look at each day as it begins. We shouldn't be pessimistic about it. We shouldn't be overly unrealistically optimistic. We should begin each day by being realistic. The reality is that each day is a challenge. And whatever the circumstances are, we're going to have to deal with them. Now, as we learn to look to God, we know that He'll give us His help. He'll bring us through the circumstances, but sometimes those circumstances are going to be difficult. If we expect everything to be like it was at the feast, then we're going to be bitterly disappointed and disillusioned, because it won't be. The Feast of Tabernacles is kind of like a bubble, and we are inside that bubble with one another. Everyone is relaxed and having a good time. We're all focused on the same purpose. We're all excited to be there to share our vision and our hope of the future. We feel safe. We feel secure with the people of God all around us, people of like mind. But when we come home, Satan is anxious to burst that bubble. we're back in Satan's world. Satan sets traps every day that we're likely, if we're not careful, to fall into. Satan provides infinite number of distractions to pull our attention away from what our purpose really is. I've referred to them in the past as shiny objects and squirrels. Satan wants to just draw our attention away and to get us interested in, excited about something else. And he is pretty clever in the way that he does that. And to be honest, we're pretty vulnerable to it. We're pretty willing to be distracted at times. You know, we're pretty willing to allow other things to become priorities for us. But here's my point. Don't let Satan ambush you. Don't let the challenges of the day come as a shock. If they do, then they will cause us distress, frustration, and disappointment. Realize each day that if you're going to keep the feast, you're going to have to work at keeping the feast. You're going to have to be prepared to deal with and to go into battle. We had a sermon in Jamaica by one of the pastors who gave us a warning. He said, when you get home from the feast, Satan is waiting for you. He's sitting on your front porch, kind of tapping his toes, arms crossed, waiting for you to step out of the car. Satan is waiting for you when you come home from the feast. Now, some might think of that as kind of over the top, maybe an overly dramatic statement, but I think in principle we see the truth in it. We come out of that bubble of the feast, and Satan has got a pretty good setup for discouraging us immediately. Don't get trapped. Don't let Satan ambush you, or let the crush of the challenges of a day diminish your hope. Go to 1 Peter chapter 1. Looking at yet another verse that we've reviewed together many times. 1 Peter chapter 1. The first few verses in this chapter, verses 3, 4, and 5, speak of the hope that we have, the hope that we see and that we experience through God. The blessing of, and the promise of the inheritance we have through Jesus Christ. An inheritance described as incorruptible, verse 4, undefiled and does not fade away. The promises of God never diminish. The promises of God never are always there. But the problem we have as we deal with the challenges of life is those promises are there, but they can become obscured by the fog and the clouds of life. The promise is always there. It never diminishes. Nothing can take it away because it's at God's throne. It says that is it's reserved in heaven for you. It's like a little present. I say it's a little bit like a box, like a present that God has for you. It's sitting right next to his throne. It's got your name on it. It's reserved for you. The promises don't go away, but sometimes we lose sight of those promises. Recognize that there will be times when we will be threatened in that way. He goes on to make that point in verse 6. In this you greatly rejoice. We've just come home from a time of rejoicing. Rejoicing before God with one another at his feast. And we rejoice in the promises and the hope that we have that are emphasized in that season. We greatly rejoice, though for now, for a little while, if need be, you're grieved by various trials. You're grieved by various trials. So that promise is always there, but sometimes it's obscured by the trials of life that cause grief. Grief is not just a tough day. It's not a small disappointment. Grief is profound sadness. That's what grief is. Peter is acknowledging that there are times in our lives when it seems like all the oxygen is just sucked out of the air. And we feel just overwhelmed by difficulties that we encounter, by the challenges that have come up. There are times when we are almost literally physically can feel the weight and the burden of difficulties. Grief is a very difficult emotion or a matter to deal with. But the promises that we just emphasized as we observe the feast don't need to be obscured by the fog and the clouds of life. We need spiritual vision so that we can see through those situations to remind us of the promise itself, which can never perish, spoil, or fade, regardless of the circumstances. But those circumstances do occur. Those challenges take place. One phrase that I became familiar with, I've heard it before, but I saw it, heard it frequently and in its immediate context, often when we were in Jamaica. Whenever there was anything that was maybe a special need that you had, if you go to the staff, the members there in the resort or the hotel, and you have a problem with there's something wrong with your room, or you need some kind of special help in some way, something maybe to be provided for you to solve an issue. The phrase that we heard over and over again was, "No problem, man. No problem, man." So I've tried to remind myself of that phrase, and it's only been 10 days or so, but when things start looking frustrating and difficult and not going the way that I would like for them to go, I try to think to myself, "No problem, man." And it won't be if we realize that for the difficulties we do have, the promises that are made to us never fail. And Jesus never fails us as we need him. Look at 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. Verse 3. Just one short statement here. 2 Corinthians 3, verse 3. As we deal with these daily challenges that sometimes can seem overwhelming, remember this, as Paul wrote it, "The Lord is faithful, who will establish you and guard you from the evil one." Yeah, all right, Satan's sitting on my front porch waiting for me to come home, but somebody bigger, my big brother, is there to take care of me. The Lord is faithful. We can depend on him. He is dependable. He is the one that it never fails us. He will establish you and he will guard you from the evil one. Now we have to look to him. We have to be willing to yield to him and follow him and obey his instructions. But as we do that, as we do our part in our relationship with him, as we draw close to him, we can rely on his strength and we can go confidently into battle each day because Jesus Christ is with us. We know about the armor that we're told of, but the reason we need that armor, described in Ephesians 6, is because we're going into battle. And if we pray and put on that armor, then we will have that help and strength to deal with those challenges of each day. So one way to keep the feast is to be realistic. Understand that this time of year is different than the feast time. But in this time of year, we rely on God's help to maintain the protection and the care that he will provide for us and to bring us through those daily battles. Don't be shaken up when you have a battle. We know that they're coming. We'll look more briefly at one more area that we can practice that will help us to keep the feast. It kind of spins out of the one that we just were talking about. It's somewhat related, but I think it's a point we can make separately. We can keep the feast by continuing in the patience of hope. you're taking notes, you can put that phrase in quotes, the patience of hope. Put it in quotes because it's a phrase that Paul used in 1 Thessalonians chapter 1. Let's look at it. 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, we see where Paul uses this particular phrase. Verse 2, he begins to, he's in this introduction to this epistle, he offers thanks to God for the members of that congregation and what he knew of them. He always prayed for them, and he remembered continually their work of faith and their labor of love. He felt very close to this congregation. It's a congregation that had been born in difficult times. You can go back to Acts chapter 19 and see the origin of the history or the beginning of the church at Thessalonica and the troubles that they experienced. And Paul reminds them or remembers their faith and their work of love and patience of hope. Patience of hope. Our hope in the kingdom, in a sense, is protected by our patience. Patience and hope are two very important qualities that really are closely related. And this phrase combines those two qualities to describe the strength that we can have in our lives, the patience of hope. Now, both of those are very strong qualities that can help us to endure difficult situations. But at the same time, they're kind of fragile in that we might have patience, we might have hope, but those can both be affected immediately by a circumstance that we find ourselves in, by those daily challenges and battles, that our hope can diminish quickly if we're overwhelmed or frightened. Our patience is used up pretty quickly because we don't like to be in uncomfortable circumstances, and it gets old very quickly. But Paul emphasizes the importance of the patience of hope. Look how Paul describes hope in Colossians, the first chapter. Colossians, the first chapter, we'll see that it reminds us of the same thing that Peter wrote about, the promise of salvation that God holds for us at his throne. Colossians, the first chapter. Introducing or getting into the letter, and similar to how he was beginning his letter in Thessalonians, verse 3 of Colossians 1. We give thanks to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, praying always for you, since we heard of your faith in Christ Jesus and your love for all of his saints. So he again acknowledges their efforts and their love and concern for one another and the way that they were living up to the standard of Christ in that way. Your love for all the saints, verse 5, because of the hope which is laid up for you in heaven. You know, the Holy Days emphasize the hope we have in the kingdom of God, the hope that we have in the message and the teaching of Jesus, that Jesus brought about that kingdom, the gospel. And just like the promise of inheritance that we saw in 1 Peter, our hope is stored up for us at God's throne. The hope which is laid up for you in heaven. Hope is a powerful resource, but it requires patience in order to maintain hope. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13 and again in 1 Thessalonians 5 that hope is one of the big three: faith, hope, and love. He also says in Romans 8:24 that we're saved by hope. If we don't have hope, especially in those times of difficulty, then we're not going to have the strength and the patience to endure. The two work hand in hand. But as I said, both hope and patience can be fragile. Our frame of mind can change in an instant if we're suddenly overwhelmed by something that is worrisome or frightening. We need to maintain the patience of hope in the face of the difficulties and the challenges that we'll face as we continue on into this new stage and this new phase of this year. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 35. We'll fall back on yet another very familiar scripture. He's speaking earlier here in this chapter, writing earlier in this chapter about the various experiences we have as we're called into the way of life that we're part of now. And there's relating here how the people were helpful to him in his time of need. But he's talking about our experiences and what we go through as we are part of the way of life God has called us into, as we deal with those daily challenges, as we deal with the grief, as we deal with the difficulties that we face in our lives. But God offers his help to us. And therefore, he says in verse 35, do not cast away your confidence, which has great reward. For you have need of endurance, and that could be translated patience, so that after you've done the will of God, you may receive the promise. We're reminded again that in the times of difficulty, we need to look back on how God has helped us in the past. And that should strengthen our confidence, give us hope, and hope then engendering patience as we continue to deal with the difficulties that we may be facing. Patience and hope. The patience of hope strengthens us to deal with the matters that arise in our lives. So we keep the feast by continuing to patiently focus on the hope of the promise of the kingdom. We keep the feast by continuing to patiently focus on the hope of the promise of the kingdom. Hope, as important as it is, hope is the expectation we have of God fulfilling his promises. And we maintain that expectation through the different circumstances that we face. And it helps us to keep in mind the positive lessons that we've learned through the feast days. So hopefully you had a very good feast this year. I know there was some, both Pigeon Forge and at Catskills, I heard there was some bugs that went around toward the end of the feast. People were not always as healthy as they wanted to be, but I've heard very positive comments about the feast itself, the messages, the fellowship, the whole experience of the feast. But as we understand it, of course, the feast is not intended to only be a good time. It is a good time. We are to rejoice and to enjoy the physical blessings. But it's much more than that. It's a commanded assembly. It's a learning opportunity. It's a time when we pause from the routine of life to concentrate for those 8 days in particular on the promises and the hope that God has offered for all of mankind. And the spiritual lessons that we learn through observing that occasion, through keeping it, is what really makes the feast great. That's what makes it special. So, it is time to start looking ahead and to plan another feast, to plan for the holy days in 2019, and in particular, the Feast of Tabernacles. It requires maybe more detailed planning. We can enjoy looking forward to that, anticipating feast fever beginning to build again, not too long into the future. But as you make your plans for next year, as you think ahead to the Feast of Tabernacles 2019, remember to keep the Feast of 2018.